Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And as you may know, the network is run by volunteers. There are about 100 of us, but we do have expenses. So we'd like to ask you to contribute a little something if you can. If you enjoy the programming we produce, then we hope that you will take a moment to go to any New Books Network page and hit the button that says Donate to NBN. And whether you contribute or not, we'd like to thank you for listening to the network.
Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week's guest is Lincoln Harvey, and we are discussing his book, A Brief Theology of Sport, published by SCM Press in 2014. Lincoln is a minister in the Anglican Church, serving in a parish in London. He is also a scholar and teacher of systematic theology. And as we learn at the start of the interview, he is a great fan and former player of soccer. Lincoln points out in his book that there has been much research and writing about religion and sport from the standpoint of history and sociology. But there has not been a careful theological approach to sport, to what it is as part of a world created by God, to the purpose it serves for people, and to whether it's something that the church should embrace or condemn. Lincoln tells us in the interview that the church, throughout the centuries, oscillated between these two positions. Lincoln, however, offers a wholly different approach to sport, and it's one that I think will be of interest even to those who follow and study sport and are not religious, especially those who are uneasy with the corruption of games by greed. Lincoln spoke to me from his home in London. Here's our interview. Our guest this week on New Books in Sports is Lincoln Harvey. Lincoln, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Bruce.
So we begin each episode with a bit of background about the guest. I will say by way of an introduction that Lincoln is a lecturer in systematic theology at St. Miletus College. He does some teaching as well at King's College in London. He's also a minister in the Anglican Church. He serves as an associate priest at a parish in Fulham. And I should probably point out, Lincoln, that you are something of a fish out of water on that side of London, home to both Fulham and Chelsea, in that you are a Gooner.
Well, I am. I am a Gooner, that's right. Although, historically, I'm a fish out of water within my own family, because my family are from these very streets of Fulham and Chelsea. So most of my family and cousins and far-reaching historical ties to Chelsea and also to Fulham. But as often happens in London, for one reason or another, some of us get aligned to other clubs, and so whole families can be at odds with each other on match day, which sometimes happens with us, particularly last week when I was with my cousins when Arsenal got thrashed 6-0 by Chelsea in a real horror show of a game.
So what then, I won't ask you then how you became a supporter of Arsenal, but what brought you to combine your interest in sport, your general interest in sport, and perhaps your specific interest in Arsenal with your study of theology?
Well, good question. It kind of happened in some respects by just reflecting on the way and the shape of my own life, in that I'd spent most of my childhood, all my better years, playing football, supporting football, running after ball, practicing my free kicks, playing every day, inside, outside, whenever I could. And then over time, through by God's good grace and a bit of luck, I've ended up as a theologian. And mixing in academic circles, one of the things you realise is that when I was chasing after a football, most of my colleagues on a sort of wider level than my particular college, but most academics weren't chasing after a ball. They were busy learning some obscure language or reading some obscure text and preparing themselves to be academics. And I found myself wondering, had I wasted my time? What was it about football that I love so much? Why? How does it fit with my life now as a theologian? And as this sort of niggling thought grew grew and I looked around, I discovered no one had really thought through, from the perspective of a theologian, what exactly sport is. And it's often the case, or rarely the case rather, if you find uncharted territory in an academic field, and it's a wonderful opportunity to begin to mark the terrain and explore it yourself. So I was able to draw my own experience and then put my head in some books and draw on my theological education and begin to think through, from a Christian perspective, what exactly sport is.
Let me get back to the point you were making about your life as a fan, as an athlete, as being somewhat separate from your life as an academic. I do know, though, at St. Miletus College that there are a number of fans and athletes on the faculty there. We've had, for instance, Graham Tomlin on the podcast in the past. And so I'll ask you how your ideas about the theology of sport, how they developed in that environment, in conversations with colleagues.
Well, the story goes at St. Miletus that when my job was advertised and a stream of people were wanting to work, it's a great college and a great environment to work in here in the UK, we were asked to do a presentation. And when the time came to my interview, I stood up and said I wanted to share some ideas about theology of sport. And apparently, precisely at that moment, the job was mine. Because those sitting in the interview panel included someone like Graham Tomlin, who's a diehard football fan, and numerous others who had long-standing love for sport. We're quite rare, though, in St. Miletus. However, we're more fans rather than, I think you used the word, athletes. We're not too athletic between us. It probably takes a few days to run 100 metres. But there's a few good golfers. That seems to be popular. But lots of football fans. So, it's a great environment in which I've been strongly encouraged, not just to sort of articulate how my thoughts were being shaped and to get constructive sort of feedback, and because most thoughts are generated by conversation. For someone like me, as an extrovert, that's really important, to be able to share ideas and then get sort of feedback. So the informal conversations around the water cooler, as they say, or by the teapot, that's probably more likely in England, were really helpful, particularly Graham Tomlin, as you've mentioned, and Stephen Backhouse and Chris Tilling and Sean Doherty and Jane Williams. It's a great crowd there who were able to help me think.
So, Lincoln, let's open up your book, and I want to start with the two premises that you set down at the beginning. And one is that sport is a universal part of human life, and the other is that religion is also a universal. So can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, it's to say it's a universal isn't to say that everything is a sport, obviously, but it is to identify the way in which not only does sport today spread across space, cover the whole globe and be followed in every corner of our land, be it here in Europe or over there or in the Far East or wherever. It's also to recognize that it spreads through time, that as far back as you go, you'll find sports. There's never a land in which there hasn't been a sport played. So in Africa, you'll have, say, something like Sudan, the Nuba tribe, which is a well-documented case, who, as soon as records are kept, are already having these tournaments, wrestling tournaments. Or it might be in China, thousands of years back, where you find games such as Kuju, I think that's how you pronounce it, meant to be now an ancient forerunner of football. Or in Mesoamerica, you have games such as Tlachtli, and again, not great with the pronunciation, or the Olympics, or in ancient Rome, that there's always been games played, and that the societies have always had sport in operation. In America, that's certainly the case. What's also evident is if you track and examine those ancient sports, what we might now see as a distinction between religious practice and sporting practice is at best blurred. And most of the ancient sports function essentially as ways in which the community enacted or dramatized or lived out the most fundamental stories that gave them shape and meaning to their life. Mostly their sort of creation myths, the way in which the world was created. Or, to take the example of of Kuju in China, the ancient forerunner of football, where the pitch was seen to be the earth, the ball was like a heavenly body, the players represented zodiac signs. Or in Sudan, wrestling, where the protagonist would be covered in ash to give this sort of ghostly resemblance as they entered the borderlands of life and death, and the games would start with them bellowing, thought to represent the noise of the cattle upon which the tribe depended. So all the way back in this universal of sport that always played, there's a very close connection with sport as a community practice that is, to all intents and purposes, a religious event in which the gods are petitioned, addressed, thanksgiving is made. So that the two run very, very closely together. And that runs through Greece, Rome. If you look at some of the ancient Roman sports, there'll be a fishing contest that would lead the sacred offerings on, to the gods, or there was the whole culture of manliness, of sort of virtue in Roman games that led to the Colosseum and the gladiators, and the way in which they would represent not only the power of Rome and its victory over nature and its conquering of all the lands and the exotic animals that were brought into the Colosseum, but also the power of Rome in face of death as the emperor passed judgment on the living and the dead. And the gladiator would learn, or would show the Roman people, how to die well. And all of these events, again, in Rome are surrounded in religious symbol and are articulating something of how religion was understood as much as how much sport was played and enjoyed.
I want to get at then how this is something you discuss in the book, how the early church viewed the games of the Romans as well as the Greeks. And I want to ask you about, in particular, the passages from the Apostle Paul's letters, and you discuss this in the book, in which he refers to sport. And as you point out, Paul makes a number of sports analogies. And today, when we would hear a minister at the pulpit make some kind of sports analogy, we would presume that this person knows and follows sport. Can we make the same assumption about the Apostle Paul, that he was knowledgeable about sport, or does he have more of a negative view of sport?
It's very clear that he was knowledgeable about sport. He regularly uses illustrations from the sporting world. He references running, boxing, chariot races. Some people argue that he, is referencing gladiatorial contests. He was certainly familiar with everything that was going on in the culture around him, and was prepared to draw on sporting images to make the points that he wanted to make. What St. Paul doesn't give us, whether it's in his letters to Timothy or in Corinthians or in Philippians, he doesn't give us a theology of sport. Sport isn't the focus of the points he's making. It's serving the argument that he's making. He's drawing from the sports of his day, often making the point that in the same way as an athlete has to be disciplined and work towards maximum performance, and how the whole of the athlete's life serves the race or the fight or whatever it is, just so the Christian also must, like an athlete, shape all of their life towards the attaining of this eternal goal. And so he's very obviously immersed in the culture, aware of sport, but is not interested in it as such. It's not, when he's referring to sport, it's not that therefore he's baptizing it and saying it's a great thing. He's simply using it as a literary device to make points to Christians about how our own lives should be disciplined towards the end.
So then, moving on from Paul, how did the leaders of the early church in its first centuries respond to the games of the Romans and the Greeks?
With the early fathers, the situation is quite clear. Sport is popular. It's a cultural phenomenon that they've got to address and engage with. Lots of Christians are clearly involved with sport in the day. However, what we find in the church fathers is a real opposition to sport, a real suspicion of what lies at the heart of sport. So you'll find someone like Clement of Alexandria, for instance, who describes the race course. He obviously recognizes that horse riding is fine, but once horse riding enters the race course, it's entering a seat of plague, as he put it, or Tertullian talk of participants in sport as being the devil's guests. And all of this opposition is, I think, best captured in the soundbite of Novatian, who said that idolatry is the mother of all games. Idolatry is the mother of all games. That what Sean Tetzberg is saying is that games, sport, are tied up with false worship. And this isn't simply the voice of the idiosyncratic preacher, because you can always find preachers to make any, to be opposed to just about anything in life, as well as to celebrate anything in life. This isn't just the preachers, though. This is the church fathers that then give shape to the church at council level. So in the early 4th century, it's decreed at the Council of Arles that anyone involved with gladiators or charioteers was to be excluded from the church, excommunication. That sport was somehow tied up with false worship. And what we find in the early church, it might not strike us as that amazing today, but at the time it's remarkably countercultural, is that the church separates its worship from sport. The church does not baptize sport in that way. It doesn't, apart from one or two exceptions later on in history where you get these oddities of people trying to bring a sport into the Easter liturgy or something like that. But the church doesn't on the whole. It instead says worship is worshipped, and sport is a corrupted, idolatrous form of worship. And it works hard to separate the two. And that is quite remarkable. And that's all built on this suspicion, long held, deeply held, that sport is idolatrous. Idolatry is the mother of all games. That captures really the church fathers' approach to sport, even though they can see benefits, if it's good for health, even though there's times when Christians will need to enter the bathhouses to clean and will partake in sports in those situations. But all the time the church is saying, yes, yeah, be careful. Sport is dangerous because of its association with false worship.
So does this hostile attitude carry over into the medieval church?
Yeah, it does. It's the pattern of the early church repeats through the history of the church. So in the medieval period, it's primarily the tournaments and the jousts, those great sporting spectacles of knights and chivalry and the tournaments. The church, again, banned it in the early 12th century. Pope Innocent at the Council of Clermont, it was an outright ban. And again, he wasn't alone, but the support of preachers and theologians was there to be found. Bernard de Clairvaux refers to, this is sort of the 12th century, refers to participants in the tournaments as sacrilegious thieves. Or Jacques de Vitry, who was a bishop, they easily match the seven deadly sins onto all of those who participate in the tournaments. Now, we might think, well, the tournaments are, you know, warlike, terrible activities. But in their day, this was the great sport. This was Premier League football. This was the most popular form of sport to play. And the church was vehemently opposed to it. Now, one of the reasons for that opposition is, I think, somewhat pragmatic. This is the time of the Crusades. The tournaments were seen as some sort of rival, and the church would not accept that and was seeking to punish the knights and their skills to the task of the Crusades. However, despite the ban by the church from on high, the sport remains popular. And eventually, by the 14th century, you find the church doing a U-turn. So that the tournament's no longer banned, but are sought to be controlled in order to provide a place where crusaders could practice. So John the 22nd overturns the earlier prohibition and the church begins to use sport again. And that tends to be the pattern. If you look at the history of the church, is opposition amidst perpetual popularity. There's something unstoppably popular about sport. And the opposition that, in face of the popularity, from time to time becomes sort of instrumental use, begins to get a thematic approach and to begin to use sport for the church's own ends. And that pattern that we find in the early church certainly repeats in the medieval church and beyond again.
And this is the pattern that carries forward. I was going to jump ahead. This pattern is then repeated with the Puritans, correct?
Yeah, with the Puritans in the sort of late 16th, early 17th century, you'll find an opposition to sport, a suspicion often tied up with the understanding of Sabbath and the way in which sport would often pollute the Sabbath in their eyes, all tied up with the sort of work ethic and the seriousness, sobriety of life, or a little bit of a capital, but nonetheless this sort of Puritan opposition. You can find, in say, John Bunyan, a good example of someone who actually believed that he had been saved from a sport. He was playing a game called tipcat, which is essentially a forerunner to cricket, something of that sort of type of sport. And he heard Lord Jesus say to him, "Will you leave your sins behind and go to heaven, or have your sins and go to hell?" And Bunyan was very sure that actually sport was inherently sinful. And so you find amongst the Puritans, certainly in Massachusetts Bay and places like that, this banning of play and banning of sports, attempt to keep the Sabbath holy, to prevent gambling, to prevent just to keep life sober in that work ethic. And that sort of Puritan posture then gets reversed in a way when you get the emergence of the muscular Christians, certainly over in this part of the world, in England, where they begin to see sport as a good. Sport becomes a vehicle of holiness. The sort of work righteousness of the Puritans is transferred into a work righteousness of sport. And sport becomes almost a rival account of salvation that then gets drawn into the church. So organizations such as the YMCA, at the end of the 19th century, sort of around the 1870s, they then have their first gymnasium, and suddenly a Christian organization is seeking to use sport as part of its outreach, part of its evangelism. But those same patterns of popularity, opposition, and instrumental use, the church seeking to harness sport to its own ends, just run like a thread through church history.
Lincoln, let's turn from your discussion of the history of the church and sport and look at your ideas about the theology of sport. And you begin that section of the book by establishing your working definition of sport. So how do you draw the boundaries of what sport is?
Well, sport is always bounded. I mean, the boundaries are there. It's a set-aside sphere. It's quite distinct from all the other things that we do, which is one of the reasons why it can often appear to be a waste of time. We set it apart, and it's an area of life which isn't for anything. So all the other things we do, whether it's get up in the morning, have your breakfast, to go to work, to send the emails, to get the paycheck, to pay for heating, the whole sort of nexus of events that we're caught up in are always serving something else. They're always for something. There's a seriousness to them. But with sport, we set it apart as a realm which produces nothing. When the final whistle blows in a game of football, there isn't a crop to harvest. There isn't a statue to put on a plinth or a painting masterpiece that you can hang on the wall. There's no car rolling off the assembly line. It's been, to all intents and purposes, a waste of time. It's for nothing. It's deeply unnecessary, which is one of the regular critiques you hear from people who scoff at those of us who love sport and can't imagine why would someone want to ruin a nice walk in the countryside with a game of golf, or why would someone spend a Saturday, rainy Saturday afternoon, watching a game of football? These things are a waste of time. People can see that there's no point, so to speak, to sport. That makes it very different. And we do set sport apart. We playgrounds, playtimes, boundaries, pitches, tracks, uniforms, kits. There are all ways in which a space, a pure space, as one philosopher calls it, is created, which is, to all intents and purposes, radically unnecessary. It's a space of freedom. But that freedom, the freedom of sport, isn't some sort of narcissistic, capricious, random, chaotic nothingness. It does have a point. All games, to state the obvious, have goals. Games have a point. There's always a reason to it. But that reason, to that this unnecessary activity is within the game itself. The game is a set-aside, unnecessary, but internally meaningful activity. And that's what distinguishes it from all, well, not quite everything else that you do, but most of the things we do. It is for nothing, an unnecessary but meaningful activity.
And can I ask you how you came to that realization? Because you opened the book with this in terms of you describe going to an Arsenal match, going to the pub beforehand, going to the stadium. And then as you're on your way home, you're thinking to yourself, there was no purpose to this. Is this something that you had as an epiphany after a match, or was it a gradual realization that you came to?
Well, a bit of both, a gradual realization. The background, we talked about this at the beginning when we were chatting, but coming in now, finding myself as an academic, as a theologian, and recognizing that I've spent the vast majority of my life doing something that was good for nothing. You know, that hadn't produced anything. I hadn't learned Greek or Hebrew or Latin, or I hadn't been reading Kant or Aquinas like a lot of academics were doing as children and young adults. I'd been chasing after ball and weighing up, what was the point of that? What is the point? And going to Arsenal, I suppose, is that it was an arena in which I suddenly felt freed from all the burdens and responsibilities that I carry each day as a priest, as a theologian, as someone who's got a mountain of emails and a mountain of marking, and this thing needs doing and that thing needs doing. And suddenly, at the game, I was in a different realm. This wasn't serious. This wasn't important, valuable. You know, pour your heart out for the team, all that stuff. But it wasn't. It had a different quality to it that distinguished it. Over time, the reflections from my own experience, reading around, because I'm not inventing this aspect of it. This is, the philosophy of sport is dominated by this insight that there's something unproductive about play. There's something unnecessary. It is a realm of contingency and freedom. And all the pieces began to fall into place. But it's the way in which that insight of the sort of non-necessity, the meaningful non-necessity of sport, mapped onto Christian teaching, that was the great sort of eureka moment for me.
So moving on from there, Lincoln, your theological speculations about sport come out of Christian teaching on creation. And this goes much deeper than Sunday school lessons that God created the earth and Adam and Eve and so on. So can you talk about this idea of the contingency of creation and this phrase you have in the book, the inescapable lightness of being?
Yes, a phrase actually comes from the work of Rowan Williams, that particular phrase. The central dogmatic point, though, is quite simple, and it isn't beyond the realms of Sunday school in many respects. The church believes that there's one God, and that the church believes that we are not that God. God is God and everything else isn't. And the church believes that if we are not God, if God is God and we are not God, then God must have created us out of nothing, because in the beginning there was only the one God. There wasn't anything else lying around with which God could look us with. He summoned us into existence out of nothing. And that belief that God creates us out of nothing establishes and identifies and celebrates the freedom of God. God wasn't forced. He didn't need to create. There was no sort of architectural blueprint that some other God had given him that he was contracted and obligated to fulfill. It was a great event of divine freedom. He created us not out of need, not forced, but freely. And that freedom of God to create mustn't be misunderstood, that it's not that God lacked anything. It's not that God needed anything. The church believes God is complete and perfect in himself as the Father, Son, and Spirit. He doesn't long for company. He keeps his own company, so to speak. He is the triune God, the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And so therefore, when God does create, it's an event of immense generosity, freely given, an event of grace, of God summoning the creature into existence. What that means, at the level of our creatureliness, at the level of our being, at our deepest, deepest identity, it means that we're not that serious, as Rowan Williams puts it. that we're not needed. We're not carrying the burden of eternity around us. There's something quite playful in us that we're not necessary. We're an event of freedom. But again, just like when we were talking about sport earlier on, we mustn't misunderstand this freedom, this non-necessity, this unseriousness in some nihilistic, bleak, despairing vision of God just doing this capriciously and randomly and by chance. We were created for a purpose, to share in the life of God. We were created for love. And therefore, at our deepest level, we are all unnecessary but meaningful. That's the nature of being a creature, that we're unnecessary but we're meaningful. And that's precisely the point where the Christian doctrine of creation, or put it the other way around, it's precisely the point where sport can be mapped onto the Christian doctrine of creation and recognized to be a place where we are celebrating our deepest identity as non-serious, unnecessary, but meaningful creatures. And the sport is like a dramatic ritual, a liturgy of that fundamental identity.
So I'll ask, so you insist then that the church should celebrate sport?
Yeah, certainly. The sport is woven into our deepest identity, as an expression of that, and it's something that we can and should celebrate. However, life's not as simple as we all wish it would be, and certainly the church doesn't understand it to be simple. Any account of creation, which is essentially what I'm giving in the book, needs to be qualified by a subsidiary account of the fall. And it's the notion of the fall and the way in which every aspect of our life is corrupted needs to be taken into account. So, for example, if you think of the in Genesis, the story of the temptation, however you read that, at the heart of it is this calling, you know, eat of this fruit and you will be as gods. And there's something about the fallen nature of the human creature that seeks to supplant divinity, to take the place of God and essentially to worship ourselves. If that's the case, then sport, if it is aligned to our deepest identity in a place where we should celebrate ourselves as creatures, it is precisely the arena where that fallenness, that desire to be as God, will play out. And that is why, historically, as the church has been so wise to discern, it is caught up with idolatry, that the creature seeks to worship nature, seeks to worship itself, seeks to worship that which is not God. And so sport, though we celebrate it, we don't do so naively. We recognize that this is a corrupted reality in which self-worship is more likely to be evident than a true celebration of our contingency as creatures.
So continuing with that, you do criticize, though, the church's stance on the past. So the church has criticized sport, but you take exception with the church in its more positive view of sport, taking an instrumental approach to sport.
Yeah, I think there's dangers with that. I think that if sport is for nothing, if sport is this radically unnecessary but meaningful activity, then to harness it to some ulterior motive is a mistake. If we lay to one side the whole question of the church for a moment and just think and reflect on how we react when sport is aligned to a political agenda, if, for example, I'll to take a non-controversial example that we'll all agree with. It was wrong for the Nazis to seek to use the Olympics as an avenue to promote their own mistaken ideology. Similarly, it's a mistake to use sport to evidence that communism is better than capitalism by a program of systematic doping. As soon as sport is harnessed to a political motive, we don't like it. Likewise, if sport is harnessed to a commercial motive, if we're only playing the game because it's the way in which we can show that Nike football boots are better than Adidas ones, then somehow we're corrupting the sport, because the sport is for nothing. And as soon as we do make it for something other than the sport, as soon as we make it serve an ulterior motive, then we are becoming spoil sports. Once we seek to align sport to something outside of sport, then we're ruining the sport. So the church, my criticism is mooted because, of course, there's very important reasons why we want to evangelize or offer chaplaincy or incorporate sport into the mission of the church. I just want to be clear that the church should be careful that we don't then become spoil sports by making sport too serious. And instead, we should just celebrate sport for what it is, as this radically free, contingent celebration of our created identity, and not seek to make it serve however noble or positive an end that we give to it.
Let me go back to the politicization of sport. And you said, how'd you put it? I'll cite an uncontroversial example, the Nazis' use of sport for political ends. Let me use a recent example, one that wouldn't have ended up in your book. It just happened a few weeks ago. And so Russia, as we know, has just hosted the Winter Olympics, the Paralympics. And it was during the Paralympics that Russian troops occupied the Crimean Peninsula, part of neighboring Ukraine, which was then annexed to Russia. So Ukrainian athletes at the Paralympics carried out various protests, but the president of the International Paralympic Committee said that they should, and this is a quote, they should leave global politics to the politicians. So would this view of marking sport as a radically autotelic sphere of human activity, does it prevent us from saying, no, you can't host an international sporting event and then invade a sovereign state at the same time?
Of course we can still say that. And I certainly wouldn't want to leave international politics to the politicians. There's a place for all of us to play, not simply as people of prayer and charity and support, but also, positive actions that we have to take to overturn injustices wherever that may be happening in the world. I don't want to rule that out, and I don't want to leave that to some aristocratic sect called the politicians. That's a project for the people. What I am saying is that there may be exceptions to prove the norm, but we need to be aware of what we're doing, that once we bring these ulterior motives into sport, then the danger is that we're corrupting it and spoiling it. Now, within an event such as the Olympics, if a protest takes place, often we will decide that the greater good outweighs the harm done to the game. It's just recognizing that sport shouldn't be routinely used for ulterior motives, although exceptions will prove the rule. And certainly we shouldn't, let's say, dedicate our lives to sporting activity with the sole intention not of just enjoying the sport, but of doing it in order to make at some ulterior point. So from time to time, it obviously will be necessary, and protests will be one of those areas which will invade the sporting arena and life will crash into it and pollute its purity. But those times we need to be careful and not do it as a matter of routine or some sort of corporate strategy, whether that's political or commercial or ecclesial. Mm-hmm. Sport is sport, and when we do these things, we're corrupting it. And sometimes we do have to corrupt things and spoil them to make a point, but not routinely and not lightly.
I want to stay with matters of politics and political conflict. And it's often said that modern sports are something of a substitute for war. And you discuss this in your book. And in fact, you cite George Orwell's phrase that sport is war minus the guns. But in your book, you turn this around in an interesting way. Can you talk about that?
It's a popular conception of sport that it is somehow a civilized form of war. That something most basic in us, perhaps a genetic evolutionary struggle in which we're all fighting to be the fittest, or some warlike gene within us, is somehow civilized and domesticated within the project of modern sports. I resist that, and in the book go to some lengths to make the case that we're better off reimagining war as a fallen, corrupted form of sport rather than sport as a civilized form of war. If sport is tied to our most basic identity as creatures, if it's woven into the reality of our identity prior to the fall, then it has precedence over our warlike reality. War and conflict and fighting are to do with our fallenness, their functions of the fall, whereas I'm saying sport is a more deeper reality. And so we need to understand not sport as a civilized form of war, but war as a corrupted form of sport. And that's a case that I make. It's a novel, it's original, it's somehow counterintuitive for many, and the weight of history is on the side of someone like Orwell. There's many more people who would see sport as a civilized form of war. But I think if my argument is right, and of course I stand by it, the case is made that that's the wrong way round, and we're putting the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Lincoln, there, I've had a couple philosophers on the podcast who've talked about the ethical lessons or benefit that we gain from sport. And so I'll turn that question to you as a theologian. Can we gain larger moral lessons from sport? So you argue that we shouldn't instrumentalize sport, but can we gain some moral lesson from sport?
I'd be wary of, again, setting sport to serve some sort of agenda in which it's an educative reality where we're playing it in order to learn these things. That isn't to deny that there's all sorts of subsidiary, secondary benefits to sport, and one of which would be, you know, fellowship, friendships, the cultivation of teamwork, all sorts of positives that we can draw from there. And I think we can also make ethical judgments about sports. If sport is tied up with our created reality, then some forms of sport will be further from our identity as creatures as others. And therefore, we can adjudicate between good and bad sports. But whether we will learn to love our enemies, or to forgive, or to be merciful, or to be generous and charitable on the sporting field, I don't rule it out, but I wouldn't set sport to serve those purposes. They're wider lessons that would be much better off going to church and reading our Bible and saying our prayers and loving our enemies and being generous to those in need. So I don't think sport and ethics are aligned too closely, certainly not in an instrumental sense.
And this is because you see sport as this really radically separate sphere of activity.
Yeah, I think sport is radically set aside, completely unnecessary, serves no purpose out of itself, outside itself. But there is a purpose to it, but it's internal. And if we begin to sort of scrape around trying to find something that will justify, something to rationalize sport, then we become spoil sports. We make it too serious. Once we seek to make sport serve something, be it a school of ethics, or be it a corporate rationale or political rationale, we're in serious danger of becoming spoil sports. Mm-hmm. And that though we will do that from time to time, though there's secondary benefits, health and fitness and, you know, social standing, all sorts of benefits from playing sport, they're not the reason for it. Don't rationalize it. Don't instrumentalize it. Enjoy it for what it is, a set-aside sphere in which we celebrate our contingency.
Well, Lincoln, we're almost out of time, and I want to come back from systematic theology back to practical theology and back to the opening of the book when you describe going to an Arsenal match. In your argument, as you've been formulating this argument, how have your theological speculations shaped your awareness of yourself as an Arsenal supporter and as a fan of sport?
Well, it's helped me understand what happens when I'm at a game. It's helped me understand the way in which together in that competitive moment as two teams struggle with each other and one wins and the other loses, although from time to time there's a draw, but as we struggle, that only together as winners and losers can we face the non-being from which we're summoned and the life to which we're called, and that together, that basically there's more to sport than winning, that winning and losing is part of it, and that sometimes allows the bitter pill of defeat to be more easily swallowed. It's also allowed me to begin to think through the nature of particularity. So when we're created, we're not created in some bland uniformity in which everything is the same. We're placed in a world that has differences. Now, the particularity of the creature is therefore something to be celebrated. And so I don't see my alignment to Arsenal at the expense of my alignment to some other clubs or some other sports as a problem that needs to be overcome in some submerging into some generous universality or something like that. It's good to be particular, and I'm free to be particular, and therefore I can be, at the depths of my being, Arsenal, rather than struggling to think actually I should be everything else. Peculiarities and differences are good. And so as an Arsenal fan, I'm happy with that. I'm just fortunate that God's given me that noble calling and that noble station, and I feel a bit sorry for all those others, particularly those unspeakable spuds, as we call them, those Spurs fans who obviously wouldn't be interested in the theology of sport, but would have to struggle with a what we would call technically a theodicy of sport, an account of evil and suffering, because those poor people have to suffer a lot of evil following such a team. I'm free to be Arsenal and delight in that.
So do you wear your red shirt underneath your cleric's collar then?
Underneath my cassock in church. No, I don't.
All right. Well, Lincoln, I'll ask you what you're working on now. So your book is titled A Brief Theology of Sport. Are you giving sport the Barthian treatment? Are you doing an extended theology of sport or working in other areas?
Well, I'm going to see how it goes. I've got a fair bit in me, more that I can say. What the work I've done, because it is somewhat trailblazing and I'm not having to piggyback on anyone else, is I'm establishing a sort of a new field of dogmatic study. I'm hoping that it generates some conversation that will then allow me to come back and to develop the argument in particular ways. The immediate project, I'm just about to, I've got a period of sabbatical, I'm just about to begin work on an introduction to systematic theology for undergraduates, for those new to the discipline. So that's the next task. Well, there's a few irons in the fire about with some articles about sport that I will be able to run off over the next year or so. So yeah, the project will continue. It feels like I've put a marker down, and the thesis certainly has legs. And one aspect of the book, I trace a whole number of further avenues of thought and exploration, and begin to sketch out accounts of competition or gender in sport, all sorts of fields that I can certainly push the argument further. But at this stage, the book's out. I'm looking forward to some academic engagement, people maybe pressing the argument in a few places, and then I can begin to develop it from there. There will be more.
All right. Well, Lincoln, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Bruce, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Lincoln Harvey about his book, A Brief Theology of Sport, published in 2014 by SCM Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, and history. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening. And enjoy your week.